netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today we're going to talk about Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows. And on the line with me is Mike Seymour. Hey, how are you?
Good, good.
So this film, I have not seen it yet, so I wanted to talk to you about what we're going to hear today.
Yeah, look, it's a superb film. I'm a big Harry Potter fan, have been for a while. Of course, I have children in the key demographic, so they've read the books many times. And it's a great triumph, I think, not only just as a good film. Of course, I think if you've not seen the previous ones, it may be slightly incomprehensible, but let's assume you've seen the other ones, it's a great film. But also, I think it's a great tribute to the London houses who are working so successfully together these days to produce some really great visual effects.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the story on FX Guide about that that animated sequence that's in the film. That was really interesting to read about. I'm anxious to see the film. I just haven't had the time on the schedule. It's been a problem. I really want to see
it. Yeah, well, actually, that sequence that you're referring to is a description of or an explanation of the backstory of the Deathly Hallows, and it comes about three-quarters of the way through the film, and it's a really interesting piece of exposition told as a very creative piece of animation. Now, what's interesting about that story is on FX Guide, is that the same post house being Framestore also did the character animation on Dobby and Creature, which is what we're talking to them about on this podcast. In fact, we speak to Christian Mance about the insanely good character work because, Jeff, you know, Gollum was motion captured. This is all just keyframe animation, and it's really, really good stuff.
Interesting. That's very unusual these days.
Yeah, not only that is it, you know, great to see on screen, but I won't give anything away if you haven't read the books, but let's just say that the performances have to carry an enormous amount of weight for the film to work, and so the character animators have really excelled themselves. And I literally was sitting in the cinema next to Ian Fales, who's joining us here at FX Guide full-time, I should say hi, Ian, and I literally said out loud in the IMAX screen, I was like, wow, because the subsurface scattering, the way the eyes look, just the way that the characters are animated, is really stand out. And unlike earlier films, we kind of hang on scenes of these characters. They're not just bouncing around and hitting their heads on the floor and sort of bouncing off the walls. They're actually on long, slow shots where you just can't hide. I think Framestore's done an exceptional job.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm anxious to hear why they chose that path and how they did it.
Yeah, well, it's in fact the first question I asked Christian was, I guess, where the performance comes from, because in a very real sense, you've got the performance from the character, voice artist, of course, the actor that provided the voice for the characters. But then, really, in every respect, the animators at Framestore are the actors for this. And I basically asked him about that idea of where the performance came from.
So thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
So, look, I think that there's so many interesting aspects about Harry Potter, and there are many things that one could talk about. And I'd really like to just focus completely and solely, when talking to you, on the digital performances of these two characters that, especially in Dobby's case, is so central to the emotional context of the film. And really, I just want to discuss with you this process of digital acting, because it's very easy to sort of characterize this in a number of different ways, but there is a performance here, and I wanted to know how you got that performance first and foremost before we get into any of the technical aspects, because I obviously you've got voice talent, the actor that's giving you the voice, but there's a lot of acting in the performances of these characters. How did you get that performance?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, obviously, being bandied about, really, about performance capture, which was obviously a route that we discussed as well up front before we got going on the work in full. But because of our heritage here at Framestore in character animation, we very much wanted to approach it from that keyframe animation point of view as opposed to a capture point of view. Tim Burke was very confident, I think, that we would be able to deliver that. And obviously David Yates is a director that is all about performance. That's what he wanted to see before he got into the what do they look like, et cetera, et cetera. And so what was filmed for Creature, Simon McBurney, who voices him, was actually in plate for most of the shots. For the over-shoulder shots, it was a small-statured double. as we politically call them. He was in plate, which was a fantastic reference. I mean, obviously, he was in plate for the actors to perform against, and it was great reference for our animators. So we had his performance. If he was in plate, we obviously had it from the as he was in camera. If it was a dialogue record later on, we had a multi-camera set up on him, and even in set there were witness cameras on him, but only from a reference point of view, if you know what I mean, rather than for tracking reference. That was our, you know, that was the fantastic thing, is we had that performance. And really, I think you can very much see, especially with Creature, that the performance that Simon gives is very much in Creature himself. And with both characters, we did a certain amount of redesign. Tim was very keen to kind of bring them more into, give them a more sense of a believability design-wise. Creature, we had a bit more license with. I mean, we had obviously done him for film 5, but we reduced the size of his ears, changed limb length and all that sort of thing, so he was a bit more believable, and also changed his ratio of his face and things, so that he was more human. Like, obviously with Dobby was a different case altogether. He is very much a designed character. But even there, we wanted to reduce the size of his eyes and just try and bring him, because I think the audience is only going to relate to these characters if they are believable. And as a human being, you know, obviously what we with both characters, we were trying to make you, we turned them very much from what they were for into small humans, you know, ugly humans at that, but small human beings. Toby Jones obviously voiced, because Simon McBurney was new to Creature, he was a different actor before, but Toby had done Dobby before film 2, and I think what David Yates was after very much was a much more, I guess because he actually dies, he was after a much more dialed down performance, and actually even more dialed down from what Toby delivered in the material that we got given to work with.
I mean, I want to take nothing away from, absolutely nothing away from Toby Jones's terrific voice work, but are we seeing Toby's acting here? Or are we seeing your animators acting in these death scenes?
No,
see what I'm getting at? Because I think it's easy to maybe, I mean, it feels to me like your animators are acting.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, Pablo Grillo, who is the animation supervisor, I mean, it was fantastic sitting in dailies with him every day, watching him directing his team. And yes, he was performing those. Well, obviously, the starting point was we always had video reference of the performance, and that was always a starting point. But more especially with Dobby, we kind of diverged away from that towards more what we were being directed to do and what Pablo felt would work better. And especially in the death scene, I mean, we did a test ahead of being awarded the work, a little Dobby animation test, which, why very simplistic, because we didn't have very long to do it, really showed them that with very, very subtle performance, what emotion you could get across. And I think that's what what the death scene exemplifies, really. And yes, a lot of it was one animator who animated all of those key shots, and it was a lot of you know, Pablo's direction, and you know all of us looking at it to try and guide it to where it wants to be, because I think it's, you know, you could go obviously very Shakespearean with a death like that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But we were just looking at all those references as well of, you know, what really happens. What really happens when somebody dies, and also wanting to, you know, just get the subtleties of that moment and the emotion across, rather than going for the obvious, if you know what I mean.
From your point of view, it's not uncommon in a fully animated feature to give an animator a chance to animate a few scenes that have no intention of being in the film just so they can get effectively in character.
Yes.
Did you have scenes that you used as a kind of, you know, point to refine the right kind of emotional and performance? I mean, effectively,
I guess so. We had
a rehearsal?
I wouldn't say that nothing we did was throwaway. So we only ever really worked in the shots we were working in, but we certainly had shots that we worked on both as an animation development and look development with Creature. The Mundungus Fletcher shot at the end of his scene was the shot that we developed all the way, and yes, kind of helped us develop, because you know, in parallel with the animated performance, we were developing the facial rig side by side, so we were doing that all the way through the project. So any little extra, the more and more we did, the more subtle we got, if you know what I mean. So that we needed more subtle control in the rig to be able to emote what the characters needed to do. And Dobby, particularly because of the size of the eyes, was particularly difficult. And really, that was one of our briefs was, you know, it's all in the eyes. There's so many animated characters that are out there, especially human ones, that have kind of got that dead eye, uncanny valley sort of look. As
and interestingly, the two characters' eyes are actually quite different.
Yes, I mean, Going Creature has very much human eyes, as Dobby still had to retain, because of his design, we suddenly couldn't completely change him, so he still retains his billiard ball eyes. But what we were trying to get in there was all of the complexity and subtlety that is in human eye movement, that it's almost imperceptible, but as a human being, you pick up on it without even knowing you're picking up on it. It's subconscious, and I think that's why that death scene, in particular for Dobby, works so well, and why you connect with it so well, because it's all those little, you know, as Pablo was saying, when we had to change eye direction and things, it wasn't as we were towards the end, you know, should he be, you know, for a while in that scene, he was very much kind of looking into space as opposed to connecting with Potter towards the end. The direction was much more to look at Potter, and it wasn't just a case of rotating the eyes to look at Potter. There's a lot more subtlety and going on than that. And so even what appeared to be a simple change was days of work, because it just meant, you know, studying it in detail. And you know, so say, you know, we were looking at, you know, the construction of the eye. We had blow up. Luckily, another show we were doing had shot huge close-ups of various human eyes, so we had that as reference. We were looking at eyes everywhere in different mediums, from TV programs that people had seen the night before to, you know, reference we found online. And I think that's the key to any character working, really. I mean, is what's going on in the eyes. And actually, that was animated first before the lip sync was done, because it was felt that, you know, if it was working, if the rest of the face was working, the lip sync obviously just, you know, added to that and finished the shot off, as opposed to it all being about the lip movement.
I mean, I only say this from a performance point of view and to applaud your animation team, but I mean, I actually found this death scene of Dobby more emotionally demanding than Dumbledore's in the previous film. And I guess one of the other interesting aspects about that is that the characters, because of the plot and because of where the characters were at this point, actually had kind of slower sort of on-screen moments, even prior to the death stuff, but of course in that in particular. You know, like Dobby in earlier scenes was dashing around quite a lot and furtive, and a Creature wasn't really kind of, you know, on point. But in this film, you actually had some quite strong moments with the characters for quite a lot of screen time. And I remember thinking both, firstly, that the cutting helped you because it gave effectively the actors time to act. But also, I found there was like a sort of a shallow depth of field that just worked gorgeously in the interiors.
Yes, I mean, it's
for
been
a bit of a painterly look.
I mean, actually, yeah, the film has been shot in much more of a naturalistic style compared to the earlier films, which are almost more theatrical in look. And I think that has helped a great deal, because, as you say, I think everything just sits in there and gives the cat time for the characters to air, for the characters to breathe.
I mean, I saw it in IMAX, and I just, like, said out loud to the guy I was sitting next to, I was just like, just wow. And it wasn't a wow on a wow shot. It was just wow on the waxy nature of the subsurface scattering of these close-up, shallow depth of field shots of the digital characters. I mean, that looked amazing.
I mean, obviously, when we were sat in our viewing room here doing dailies, you know, we were very mindful of the fact that the huge head that we would be seeing that we were seeing here will be spread 50 foot across the screen. So that was also the detail. But I think the challenge with it was not to, I mean, almost the quote we'd put against it was so good they'd think it was captured, if you know what I mean. I think it's the subtlety that we were, rather than doing the obvious, I think, with those sort of things. And obviously, as I said, our animation team over the years has just built experience on top of experience doing these sorts of characters, and I definitely do think that we hit a sweet spot with this show, in terms of performance and look. But Dobby as a character, I mean, I think he wasn't favoured as a character, it has to be said, by the current production team. And
what do you mean by that?
In that, I think in the last film, he was very much comic relief and an overtly, not overacted performance, but you know what I mean, a very comic character. And yeah, that didn't really suit the tone of this movie, and also the tone of his eventual, you know, his destiny in the film. So I think all the time, any comment that came back was always to tone down the performance. And I think that was something that, you know, if it had been a captured performance, would have been much harder to do. But as it was animated, we were able to dial it down in the correct ways.
I think the other thing was, and obviously in any translation of a book to a film, you're going to cut stuff. But on reflection, after I left the cinema, I pondered that if you had a chance, I would have loved to have seen scenes from the book that Creature didn't do, where he becomes basically incredibly loyal to Harry and starts cooking the meals and all that stuff, because I just wanted more screen time with Creature.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a shame, really, because well, I mean, he's in two scenes, but, you know, his hero scene does beg you to see him more, because, I mean, he's a more sympathetic-looking designed character anyway, so I think he, therefore, I think from what people have been saying, appears to be the strongest work. But I think that's just because, again, you relate to him more. But yeah, I agree. Really, it's a shame. And to be honest, they're in every book, aren't they? But they've only been in two films, and I don't know whether that's just because people have been, as I say, scared of bringing them back for various, you know, creative reasons. But yes, I mean, we were lucky in that. You know, certainly, you know, Dobby scenes, or both of them, as you say, we had long shots, which were obviously challenging, because there's no, as you say, cutting away or focusing on another actor. You're staring at our work. But yes, it's brilliant to get an opportunity to work on a performance like that, and one that you kind of think that they're just another actor in that shot. You know, they're not I think that's why the death scene works, because by then I think the audience has completely forgotten that they're looking at a CG creation.
Can we switch gears slightly and just discuss the technical aspects? Because obviously, as much as the performance is terrific, they're technically executed superbly. So the setup for doing this, to walk me through what you actually had on set, in terms of lighting reference, and how you translated that lighting reference to what I presume must have been some kind of new subsurface scattering, because it really had a lovely quality to it.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, pretty much what was shot on set was the standard stuff. There were witness cameras there for the performance, and it was just the usual HDRI and chrome ball and et cetera. There wasn't anything special. We had a lot of set photographs that were taken, and basically, the big big difference in how they were lit is we lit them with bleed cards from HDRI photographs projected onto the set geometry, as opposed to using any diffuse lights. Well, instead of using a standard diffuse light setup, which gives you that much harsher fall off of shadows, and as you say, with the scatter, basically all of the rendered layers were it was two levels of scatter instead of having a diffuse light pass, and the lights themselves were, we took high dynamic range photographs and used them to effectively bounce light, bleed light onto the characters instead of using a spotlight pointed at them. So it meant that what you were seeing was...
Are you talking about spherical harmonics, or are you, when you say that, are you setting that, or are you, sorry, referring to the subsurface scattering being like more...
Well, instead of lighting it with a light rig of here's a spotlight here and a fill light over here.
Are you using the HDR lights?
We're just using HDRIs to light them with instead.
And I think that's giving you almost a directional ambient light, isn't it? I mean,
yes,
it's effective.
Effectively, yes. And it also, the fact that we were working then with two levels of scatter, so a deep scatter and a shallow scatter.
Is that wavelength based, or is that when you say those two, are they reacting to different wavelengths differently, or what's causing?
There is basically different thicknesses of skin, I guess, so that you're getting, and so that you end up with something that looks, a lot more scattery than would be, than what we have been working with in the past. We've been used to a much more standard diffuse. Diffuse and ambient setup for lighting our creatures, and what it results in, as I said, is as well as the scatter, it's just the shadow fall off is much more conducive to looking like skin. It's very much subtler, and I think that was the textures. We spent a lot of time in texturing, and also I think the rigging. There was 3 man-years worth of rigging for both characters, together. And a lot of, on past projects I've done, spent time doing all the, your puppet rig and deformation rig, but then you've done a lot of creature effect stuff to do muscle jiggle and all that sort of post the rig stage. Yes, we did do muscle jiggle and skin slide, but those were much more of a, almost like an icing on the cake thing at the end, because the rig did so much, all of that muscle deformation and seeing tendons under the skin and all that sort of thing was all in the render rig. So we were, as I said, we had those riggers on to the very end. So any shots that we kind of thought, you need to see a tightening of the, particularly the, we were looking at everything, how when you tense up your neck, what you see there and how that actually connects all about the face, all of the physical stuff that happens. And I think all of those things tie up together to make what is a photoreal character.
It's in these interior shots. It's really from a lighting point of view, it's a study in diffuse, because it's really not like the skin is playing strongly in specular. And when you come to the muscles, as you say, it's in highly articulated. But I think the other thing that was slightly noticeable to me when I tried to break out of the story to look is there was a lot of good stuff, even in things like the very subtle hairs. They're obviously not hairy characters, but they're obviously subtle hairs on the skin. And also the cloth. And I think both of those things also, those extra sort of elements, all seem to tie in well.
Yeah, I mean, the cloth, actually, this, again, we tried to do something that was not, because we started off with a cloth that was, moving around every time they moved and did what you expect CG cloth to do. But then the more and more we were looking at what cloth actually does when you're, if you're wearing a shirt or a, I suppose they're wearing like a sack, actually it doesn't do too much. So actually, we ended up dialing down what the cloth was doing all the time. And
Is that conceptually because of the friction over the skin, or is it more because of the inert nature of the stiffness of the cloth?
Well, no, it was mainly to make it feel like it was all the time that we were trying to make it feel like it was gripping the skin, and that you haven't got that. Because I think often with CG characters, you can almost get a feeling that they're two separate things, and that the cloth is almost a character in itself. As here, we wanted to focus on what Dobby and Creech were doing and not what they're closer doing. Obviously, in key shots, like when you first see Dobby on the beach, and I think the blowing simulation, the wind blowing simulation that we put through the cloth, adds loads to that shot. And at certain key points when they apparate and things, we did additional moments like that. But most of the time, all the direction we were giving the artist was always to be dialing back what the cloth was doing. But at certain moments, because it was meant to be, both of their cloths are quite light in nature, so there was still that kind of thing of trying to, on the edges and things, of not getting that rigid feeling.
I assume it was deliberate, but in Croatia, sorry to interrupt you, but it just, obviously the blowing and the wind stuff, but I guess for Creature, when he's in those earlier shots, it almost felt like there was a clamminess to his skin that you actually do kind of get with elderly people, especially in like kind of nursing homes, that I presume was deliberate. It just felt...
Yeah, I mean, we actually, because we've actually got a member of staff here who's... an elder member of staff who
I was about to say he had a member of staff who was in a nursing home. I was saying
no. That's incredibly... Well, probably something close to that, but no, we got an elder member of staff here who kindly sat for both photo reference and video reference, as well as us obviously looking at all the time at pictures of very old people. And yes, there was that. We wanted to try and get that translucency, and as you say, that that feeling of thinness to the skin that you do get as you get older, as well as the characteristics of like liver spots and all that sort of thing. But yes, I think in that scene, we were very much, when we look at his arms and things, we were just trying to get that sort of slightly sweaty nature, which is what we were looking at with Dobby's death as well, is trying to think, what would you be if you had just been stabbed? What would you be? You'd be probably in shock, so suddenly the blood would drain away from certain parts of your face. We also did compression maps, which was basically a pass that came out of lighting, which basically showed you where the geometry was most compressed, so that we could use that in comp to dial blood out of, blood out those areas effectively, as would happen in the human face, which was a subtle thing that if you turned it, you don't really notice, but if you turned it on and off, you really did notice. And I think it's all those sort of imperceptible things that help make him look more real. But again, we were looking at areas of where do you actually sweat, around your top lip and your brow, and just making sure that where we were seeing specky reflection stuff, it was just in those areas and in subtle areas. So again, by the time we got to doing those shots, we were able to spend time on each of them. Very much sort of art directing, the look of him in every one.
So there are some shots with some interaction earlier on, some handshakes in the kitchen and stuff, but can we talk about the actual interaction with live action now?
Yeah.
Because we've talked about the 3D, but actually on the beach, as I understand it, you actually had to do sort of basically plate cleanup and either double or dummy removal to...
In some of the... Basically, in the shots where you're looking down on Dobby, where you've just got a hero shot of him, most often that there was a weighted maquette was made, which was a beautiful... We had him in here for reference and everything, but that was what Daniel Radcliffe was holding in those shots. But in some shots, they also had from the first shot, the shot where he collapses into his arms, and all of the wide shots had a body double in there instead. And the body double was at least twice as big as Dobby.
Which so meant you mean that, an actor?
Yeah, which meant that Regiment, and Daniel Radcliffe was, as soon as we put Dobby in there, Daniel Radcliffe's hands were in the wrong place. They're holding a much bigger thing. And so that was the immediate challenge with those shots. So virtually straight away, we from the block stage of animation, we were kind of wanting to lock down where Dobby was going to be so that we could get on with the plate restoration work. And that involved a lot of work between our tracking department and our paint and roto and comp department.
Did you end up having to do digital versions of Harry's hands and limbs?
Yes, there are. Replacing. We did a mixture of work basically between, I mean, now the fact that we're using Nuke made that all a lot more easy, but there was a lot of work with doing very detailed body tracking of cloth, which we did in different sections, which was then had sections projected onto in Nuke and painted on. And then, yes, we had to, animation placed, we had a body double, we body tracked, sorry, tripping over my words, we body tracked Danny Radcliffe for some shots and then moved his arms into the, and hands and posed them into the right place and where possible, because we didn't want to have to get into doing lit CG hands and things of that, because it was hard enough doing Dobby and Creature. So where possible, we used the plate photography to use those textures that are in plate and reproject them and then paint those up, which generally worked, even if we were taking three frames and mixing between them and all that sort of stuff. But essentially, that process went on for about 6 months, cleaning up those alongside the work being done. So there was a lot of, that was the biggest comping challenge of the job, really. There was obviously a lot of compositing work in. Again, Tim very much wanted, and I wanted as well, to make sure that we were getting all those sort of the subtleties of a filmed plate, the bloom that you get off of highlights, the the colour aberration you get on high contrast areas where you're also seeing red bleed, the fall off of focus, all those sort of things were things that we were paying attention to in great detail. And I think that's, again, what makes it look so filmic at the end of the day as well. So, it was a great challenge.
So now I've deliberately constrained you from talking about all the other stuff that you did, but obviously Framestore did a lot of other interesting things. But just in terms of the character animation on these two characters that we're focused on, was that a small, tight team, or was that, a lot of
people? Yeah, because we worked on it for basically about 16 months, and we had turnover pretty quickly and of a couple of scenes, which obviously meant some stuff changed quite a lot, but that meant that we were able to do the ideal thing, which was we had a small but very good team working on the show for a long time. So we had, I think we inflated to about 60 crew overall at its most, but that included all of Paint and Roto and all the trackers that were working on it. As far as animators, there are about 15 animators. But as it got moved into lighting, there are only about 6 lighters and compositors working on the show at all at any one point. Which meant that, it meant that essentially you had a character in a scene being concentrated throughout that whole scene by one artist. And that, I think, is what also has made the work look so consistent and so good.
You mentioned that Nuke for the compositing. Can we just talk about what actual tools the animation and lighting team were using? What was it done in?
It was all modelled in Maya, but with Mudbox and ZBrush displacements painted, sculpted. It was rigged and animated in Maya and rendered through RenderMan, but through our proprietary FRibGen, which is our bridge between RenderMan and Maya. And then, comped in Nuke and some paint and roto done in Silhouette.
So I presume because it was a subsurface scattering approach, you were primarily trying to nail the lighting and look as part of the 3D render rather than doing a sort of incredible multi-pass, multi-faceted OpenEXR through to the comp team for the
Yeah, cameras? I mean, we still render, you know, the compositor's still got a lot of layers to comp with, but yes, certainly the whole idea is that, again, the three leads who led each sequences, there was, you know, one person who did the creature scene, one person who did the death scene, one person who did Dobby's big scene in Malfoy Manor, and one person who also did the dungeon scene. And I think the only scene that was kind of mixed up between everybody else was the creature and Dobby scene. But it meant that we could, because you had that concentrated collaboration between departments, because we've always found it quicker, obviously, because you can interactively change stuff in comp much quicker. But then we would go back to lighting and try and push all of that back into the shader. So eventually what was coming out as a beauty render looked pretty fantastic and close to, which also meant that we were able, by the end of the show, when we were showing animation to David Yates, we were able to publish a new animation, render it, and put it through a comp script and show him a finished looking comp every time pretty quickly, you know, with a day turnaround. So, I think that collaboration between, when I think generally the comp and lighting, that area is blending, and there's a big grey area between them now anyway, I think, especially because of the advent of Nuke and film VFX.
And we discussed the lensing, and I said how much I like that shallow depth of field and some of the other optical effects. Was the stuff coming out of 3D without articulated depth of field or matching depth of field and without kind of lens curvature and stuff?
Lens distortion was put back on. I mean, we understore plates, yeah, do all of the stuff, and then that goes back on based upon the lens grid for the shot. But what we did in comp is we even studied those lens grids to see what actually, because you've got black and white lines, you could see actually what was going on for a particular lens, as in how much lens aberration and color.
Chromatic aberration
you were right. Getting and all that sort of thing. So we looked at it from that point of view, but then, of course, you're looking at it, matching it into the plate. So, yes, all of that subtle depth of field, chromatic aberration. Also, we did a lot of CG always comes out looking very sharp and perfect. So there was an awful lot of subtle diffusion we were doing on different areas of their skin to make them... and making sure that we were filling in, that there was no black, you know, teeth and things like that, that there's nothing in there that was black or looked like it was. The teeth actually were another thing that were particularly hard to get, because there's technically, I suppose, there's no shadows in them because they're so scattery. So again, a lot of that was a lot of comp work just to tweak that on top of the render. But as usual, the kind of, as a, you know, on past shows, I'd say it's sort of 50-50 rendered to what's done in comp, but here it was much more weighted in terms of what came out of the comp and what came out of render, and the comp was, again, the icing on the cake, sitting it into the plate.
And just in terms of just finishing up, in terms of how you reviewed these with the director, I mean, you could technically place a digital character in a scene mathematically correctly, but it just doesn't have the kind of hero lighting that you want for a character who's significant to the plot. Did your team give that kind of what I'm going to call creative lighting direction? Did that happen in isolation? You guys did it yourselves? Was there anything from the director or even for the DP for that matter? Because
no, I think most of the time it happened ourselves, because I think often or not, when you're... from my experience of shooting things with CG characters in them on set, they tend to forget about the CG character, and that'll be solved later. More often than not, here they did a very good job of placing something in the shot and lighting to fit that. But again, we were looking at it was quite, you know, when he's on that on that wall with Harry, Hermione, and Ron surrounding him. We had good lighting cues from their skin, and we were always looking at, even in the tabletop scene. You know, we were just looking at their skin, and it was always, it's always a hard sell because obviously Harry and all of the kids had very pale skin. Mum Dungus in that scene has got quite olivey skin. So it was very, very, very subtle little changes we were making, because in the end, Creature, they just wanted to look really, really pale. So all the time we were kind of, this is one of those things that you would kind of do and you think, oh, that looks wrong, come in the next day and think, oh no, that actually looks pretty good. But we were pushing it more and more and more. So it was, yeah, I mean, say you can do things, I firmly believe you can do things that are technically right, but to actually make a beautiful looking picture, it's instinctively looking at what, you know, what makes something look good as opposed to what's technically right, if you know
yeah,
what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest one of these to discuss, I guess, is eye light. I mean, eye light's so important, and you're not going to have eye light from the stage because there's no eyes to light as well.
Yes, I mean, we had separate lights on eyes and mouth that we were, and we were lifting areas underneath eyes and all those sort of things, so as well as the actual, you know, eye lights in the eyes themselves. We had control over all of that. And so again, per shot, we were dialing that in and out, looking at the actors, and yeah, seeing what was going there. But yeah, again, the eyes, making sure that the eyes actually had, you know, light on them so that you could read them, was very key. But particularly with Creature, it was great because Simon was in the plate, so you could see right. a lot of what you're seeing and him is what's in Creature. Dobby, we had to take a bit more of a cue from the actors in plate because Toby was never in the plates we were comping. But yeah, it was, you know, a challenge. But yeah, something that, you know, I'm very proud of the work that that I was part of. It was great.
Well, yeah, congratulations, and really tremendous emotional impact. So great.
Well, yeah, I think our the cast and crew screening, I unfortunately couldn't make it, but my producer was sat next to my CG supervisor, and at the death scene, she bashed him on the shoulder and was like, we've got crying next door, and the girl next door to her was sobbing her heart out. So I kind of think, yeah, I really hope it has that sort of reaction. And as I say, I kind of think that, you know, that hopefully people just forget they're looking at a, you know, a CG character.
Well, yeah, congratulations to you and all the team, and thank you for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
That's all right. Cheers, Mike.
Well, thanks, Mike, and thanks, Christian, for taking the time to talk to us. That was
interesting. Yeah, it was great, yeah. I really enjoy these discussions when as you know, Jeff, we made a policy decision about a year or two ago to stop trying to cover every shot in every article and actually to drill down on one aspect, which we think is interesting, and try and eliminate that by way of giving, I guess, a bit more in-depth coverage to these films. Because, I mean, when you've got 1,200 visual effects shots in a film, if you just catalogue every shot, you're never going to touch on each one for more than a couple of seconds. Nice to be able to drill down a bit.
Right. And also, I want to point people to the VFX show that you just released, I think, as we were recording this. The VFX show, if people aren't familiar with it, is another podcast we do that you host, and really talks about visual effects in a film in a really, in a more, I wouldn't want to say fan base, but how would you describe it?
Well, it's a panel discussion. Obviously, in these podcasts, we try not to be too editorial. We try to discuss the facts and how people have done them. We're not the story. In the VFX show, it's the exact opposite. We try and discuss it from a panel. We get a panel of current VFX artists from all over the world, and normally about three or four, and we sit down and discuss the film. We discuss the film a little in terms of just a film. It's hard to separate from the effects, but most of the time we're just discussing the effects and what we like, what we don't like. In this film, of course, we discussed this sequence with Dobby and Creature quite a lot, but also the particle animation and just the destruction sequences and particle sims and just the things that we noticed about the films. And obviously, we're not hesitant to be critical, so if there are shots we feel didn't work, we try and flag those. So we always try and articulate why, hopefully that's a constructive discussion.
Yeah, I also like that the VFX show does historical films. It's not just the latest films, which it usually does the latest films, but it also goes back and looks at things like Back to the Future and Terminator and Apollo 13. Apollo 13 I particularly enjoyed.
Yeah, it's funny. Some of the very senior creative staff that did that film actually ended up listening to that on set of another film they're currently filming on. I can't discuss that, but just to say that we got feedback from them that they really enjoyed listening to the podcast. And it's kind of daunting, actually, when you do these podcasts and you find out that the supervisors or the directors are actually listening to the podcast. But, yeah, we really appreciate the feedback that everyone gives us on those, and they are incredibly popular, those retro shows. And, you know, Jeff, so much of what we do today is built on the shoulders of the work of those that went before us. And I can remember going to DD and actually going on set with Price Petrel when Apollo was being shot and looking at the miniatures and stuff. And I got to tell you, it was at the time and to this day something that I really, really enjoyed immensely.
Sure, sure. If people are looking for those podcasts, by the way, they can find them on the top of the homepage at FX Guide. There's a podcast link and you'll see the VFX show. Some people, I don't think we've ever promoted that here on this podcast. So I just thought I'd mention that. It's also available on iTunes. If you just search for VFX show or FX Guide, you should find it.
Yeah, and also I'd suggest that if you wanted to send us any feedback about this show or any of the other podcasts or articles that we have, please use the Contact Us at the top of the FX Guide page. You'll see it on the right there. And I'd keep an eye on FX Guide over the next week or two because some interesting things afoot from our friend in the Chicago office and his team. So yeah,
is he actually in the Chicago office this week? I think all of us are in the air at some point in the next couple of weeks.
Yes.
Multiples at the same time, I think. We're all moving around right now.
Yeah, we could all just stay in the same place. It would save a lot of money in airfares. But yes, you're coming here. I'm going to Korea. I think John's in Europe. But yes.
Yes.
But we have some really good stories coming up. Some more podcasts on Harry Potter, discussing some of the other aspects of the production of that. And Jeff, you've got some good podcasts coming up as well.
Yep, I've got some stuff coming with the Labor series. We'll talk about more of that as it comes out. I'd rather not get into that right now. But, you know, we're definitely following up a lot. There's a lot developing in that area. So we're trying to get as many people to talk to us as we can right now.
Yeah, and we really appreciate your support. And thank you so much for downloading this podcast. And it's been a few years now, Jeff, since you and I were online and you said, hey, I've got an idea for a name for a website. Let's call it FX Guide.
Yeah, I was looking that up the other day. 99, I think it was.
And it literally was. You had a copy of TV Guide on your coffee table, right?
I don't remember. I just remember we were looking for a name, and it was we just kind of threw that out there and had no idea about
it. Full credit to you. You came up with a name.
Had no idea where we'd end up now this many years later doing so much different forms of content and evolving into FX PhD as well. And it's been a great ride, and I get a lot of great feedback. I mean, it's really been funny with the podcast. I'll actually go to meetings here in LA, and if I stand up to ask a question, almost every event somebody comes up and says, hey, I recognize your voice from the podcast.
Yeah, well, I've certainly enjoyed hanging out with you for this last 12 years, whatever it's been, or 10 years, whatever it's been. So thank you. And as I say, thank you guys for listening. It's only through your support that FX Guide continues. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jeff Huser, and for our friend John Montgomery, see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.